House Committee on Judiciary, February 4th, 1987, 6 p.m., Portland Building, Portland, Oregon. Subcommittee 2, meeting to hear House Bill 2039, I'm sorry, 2029, House Bill 2333, and House Bill 2437.
This is a hearing by the Subcommittee on Corrections and Criminal Law of the House Committee on the Judiciary. And we're really here to, we came up into the Portland area to hear on several bills, one of which is important, I think we'll find out, to Multnomah County. That's House Bill 2437, dealing with what's called the ABC Felon Bill. And we have a number of people who are here to testify on that bill, and some of who have come some distance and who need to get back to other business and things like that. So we're going to go a little bit out of order in the on the printed agenda and open up the hearing on House Bill 2437 and take testimony on that. And I think I've got an order of people who are on this. We'll move through that bill and then through the other two bills and then take public testimony as we have time. This meeting is scheduled to go from 6 until 9 o'clock. Hopefully we can finish it prior to that time, but we'll stay until we have everyone heard. I'd like to, there are members of the committee here with me, Representative Bauman, who's from Portland area, Representative Springer, who chairs the Judiciary Committee and is also from the Portland area here, and Bill Taylor, who is legal counsel of the committee, is on my right. So we'll open the hearing on House Bill 2437, and Sheriff Fred Pierce.
I'm really pleased that we can be here tonight to speak to your committee, Representative Burton. As most people know, that certainly on the committee, that you sponsored House Bill 2437, and the willingness of you to hold your committee to hold a hearing here, where we have so much of our problems, is really great. House Bill 2437 is Multnomah County's top priority this year, their legislative priority in this current session, and it's certainly a priority of the other counties of the state, as evidenced by the Association of Oregon Counties support of the proposal. I believe that the House Bill 2437 does once and for all delineate the responsibilities for sentenced offenders in this state, and I think that's really important. It's a mixed bag right now, with some sentenced felons being sentenced to the custody of the Corrections Division and some sentenced felons being sentenced to local facilities, and there is no absolute delineation of that responsibility. Decision on that is one of the judiciaries, and it depends on the length of sentence they get. So we think that it ought to be settled and still deal with the concerns of the judiciary, and I think this does, and I'll go into that in a few moments. We did an actual analysis of the sentenced felons in Multnomah County in 1986, and the average daily population of sentenced felons in Multnomah County jails for the past year is 250. Now, if the 250 were placed in an institution such as OSCI, or if the OSCI, the Oregon Correctional Institution's daily rate were used as a guide for either contracting with local facilities or having a facility in which they have to manage this population, it would, at $44.77 a day, Multnomah County's population of sentenced felons would amount to $4 million annually. That is a fairly significant sum, and I think we all realize that, and it's entirely possible that as a result of the cost involved, that perhaps that could not be done immediately in this session. However, I think it would do two things, the passing this bill. It would identify once and for all, as I said earlier, that felons are the sentenced felons are the responsibility of the state, and in some way it could be phased in if that was necessary. However, how that's done, I think, is not as important as understanding that we are, in fact, going to have, consistent with the ways and means and the decisions and the legislature's decisions, up to 1,660 additional beds in the state as a result of Governor Neil Goldschmidt's initiative and placement in his budget of the corrections package, which provides for 700 and some beds additional in the correctional facility in Pendleton, Eastern Oregon, which would be hard beds. But the ones that are important, I think, to this proposal are the 900 local minimum security beds that would be state-operated or contracted for. And although Governor Goldschmidt didn't propose this felon bill, it is in concert with his conceptual use of those spaces, which are minimum security. And generally, when someone is sentenced for a felony to a probation with the condition of some time in a local jail, minimum security custody is generally sufficient to deal with that person, or they would be sentenced to the penitentiary. Knowing full well that someone sentenced to a year in the county jail does just slightly over 6 months. If it's 6 months, they do slightly over 90 days. We know that those people are going to be on the street very, very quickly, and the judiciary also knows that, and they take that into consideration when they decide to sentence them to the lesser sentence. One of the concerns that I know the judiciary have, I've discussed it with a number of Multnomah County's judges, and that is the inability to maintain jurisdiction over people once they're sentenced to the corrections division. And it is one of the reasons that people are sentenced to probation terms with conditioned on some time as a punishment generally in local facilities. This bill continues to provide for the ability of the judge to sentence someone to up to a year as a condition, or sentenced to someone to probation, and as a condition of probation, to be confined up to 1 year, and continues to maintain jurisdiction over that person. So the only difference to the current situation is the bill provides for the sentencing of this individual to the custody of the corrections division, and the corrections division then would place the person. The intent of certainly of myself in working on this and on the governor's plan was that for the most part these would be placed in local minimum security facilities, although they would be funded by the state. There are two technical modifications of this that I would like to ask the committee to consider if it's appropriate to do that at this time, Representative Burton. On page 12, or excuse me, on page 1, line 12, if we delete the second, third, and fourth word, in other words, delete the law requires, and add after a county agrees under subsection 1 of this section, then it goes on. In other words, It wherever the law requires is its current language, and we want it to read whenever, we would like you to consider having it read, whenever a county agrees under subsection 1 of this section to incarcerate in its local correctional facility a person sentenced to the custody of the corrections division, the division shall reimburse the county for the actual costs of such incarceration up to but not exceeding for each day the person so incarcerated what it would cost the division per day to incarcerate in the Oregon State Correctional Institution. We think that language is more explicit as to providing for the reimbursement to the counties. On page 2, on line 12, in order to separate felony and misdemeanors, we would like to add the language where it now says, takes out the words to the county jail, add the language, if a felony. And that then would read, be confined if a felony under the authority of the Corrections Division to a correctional facility designated by the division. Then add, at that point, if a misdemeanant, confined to the county jail. And the rest of the language would be as it is. So there wouldn't be a misunderstanding that misdemeanors would be confined to the confined by the Corrections Division. I want again to say that this bill is not only Multnomah County's number one priority, the Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners, but it also is endorsed by the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, some of the members of which are here. Jim Hennings is here, and I don't know if he will leave before he is able to testify. Jim Hennings is the public defender, a Metropolitan Public Defender, head of that organization, and is very supportive of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee that you might have. That completes my testimony.
Representative Springer?
Sheriff Pierce, if I understand your request, if this bill were to pass, you anticipate that if the funds were available, that Multnomah County might be able to receive up to $4 million a year if you still have the current load of felons incarcerated in your jail. Is that?
If the decision was by the Corrections Division to contract with the county for the incarceration of that, and it was agreed upon by the county to continue to confine 250 persons, that would allow us to provide the necessary facilities to accomplish that purpose, which is not the case today.
Can you give us some idea how you would spend that money? Would there be new facilities opened up, or facilities which are now not being utilized, would they be opened?
Well, two things, if I may. One, I'm not sure that there would be sufficient room in our current facility, or I'm sure there wouldn't be sufficient room in our current facilities. There is one facility which we are currently having some discussion over that formerly was a women's center that would provide 80 of those beds. But there also is, as I say, the 900 beds with construction costs attached in the governor's budget, some of which, as 40% of the inmates come from the metropolitan area this state, would be in the regional area of this of the three counties, in which some of those facilities, either managed by counties or managed by the state, would in fact be available. I think there would have to be additional facilities provided. Whether they were provided and then managed at the county level as a contract, I don't know. I think that would be something that would have to be negotiated, but there would have to be additional facilities.
As I think you know, this the governor's corrections proposal, which is very ambitious and commits a lot of dollars, particularly to Pendleton and to the 900 beds and some operational costs, at this point doesn't include the funds that would be necessary to fund 2437. That's going to be something that has to be resolved in Ways and Means, of course. Another option that has been discussed by the Jail Overcrowding Project would be to change our statutes to take away the authority of a circuit judge to send someone to the county jail, or perhaps limit that. What would be your response if we didn't have money and the only way to help you control the number of felons in your jail was to limit the authority of the judges? How would you respond to that scenario?
Representative Springer, as I understand the OJOP, it's the 90 days that a judge would be limited to sentencing someone to, as a condition of probation, to 90 days in the jail. That wouldn't materially reduce the number of sentenced felons in our facilities. It would reduce it. But the fact is, many of those felons are in there for 90 days. They're in there for 6 months in which they don't serve over 90 days. It would still impact negatively on our facilities. I happen to believe that there are insufficient facilities to deal with this. I think that I want to make it clear, I don't think it's inappropriate for judges to sentence people to incarceration as a condition of probation. I just believe it's inappropriate to do that in a county jail for felons. We don't have the resources to manage that kind of a population. I think that we need that kind of a sanction available, and I would hesitate to reduce the ability, two things. I also think that I would hesitate to reduce the ability of a judge to do that, although I question where they go. Secondly, I believe that the judge has decided to put somebody on probation with some incarceration, that allows them to modify the sentence, deal with the individual on an individual basis. As we all know, once they're sentenced to the Corrections Division under the current law, all control and management of that inmate is out of the control of the judiciary. I think it's another way of dealing with some of the criminals and keeping them to some degree in the local community. That's a second reason that judges, in fact, sentence them to the local jail, is so that they can remain in the community. Particularly those who have community ties, they can enter the work release program at the local level. And as you know, we later this month we'll be opening up our new restitution center. I wouldn't want to preclude that kind of an option. We just have far too few sanctions available to deal with the criminals we have currently in custody, and I wouldn't want to see that stop. That doesn't mean that there couldn't be modifications in a variety of laws, perhaps, to adjust what the overall crime sentencing for crime may be. But I think just the limitation of 90 days would not materially reduce the population we have.
Can you give us a ballpark figure in terms of the breakdown on the 250 felons that you referred to, A, B, and C?
If you bear with me for just a moment.
Sure.
It is approximately two-thirds C and a third A and B.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that for a minute, right now, your numbers in the county jail, how many of those people who are incarcerated in that facility right now would fall under the, if this bill were passed today?
250.
That's right now. So that's actually
going to be a little higher. I think that unsentenced, I think that would still hold true. We went through December, but
so that's on a daily average.
That's a daily average over 1986.
On an annual one.
Okay. Right. Sometimes it's a little higher, sometimes a little lower.
Your question, Representative Bowman.
Yeah. For the two-thirds who are C, there's a payback that comes from the state right now. You know what the amount?
I don't know that amount, but the fact is that currently under the state law, that is used for community corrections and not for jail, although in Multnomah County we have, Board of County Commissioners have used some of that, $500,000 of that money for offsetting the C's. The remainder can only be used in non-custodial situations, programs and so forth. So that doesn't help us. Our main problem at $4 million a year, we are using approximately $500,000. That will be, as soon as we open the restitution center, in fact, be a program itself and not be within the jail. There is a proposal by the Corrections Division to allow some of the community corrections funds in legislation that I understand is introduced to be used some for incarceration as well.
One follow-up. But the consequence of changing the formula so that there would be a payback for all felons A, B, and C would have some serious consequence on another Multnomah County program, which is community corrections.
Well, if if the decision was to take all the community corrections money out of community corrections and apply it to the ABC felon bill, which I wouldn't suggest. Community corrections is a valid program, and will in fact perhaps allow some if the language of the statute is modified, to use some for some of the incarceration. But even then, there isn't that much that comes from Multnomah County. I don't want to see us reduce our ability to deal with criminals in a less than incarcerative manner, or not to have the ability when they complete their term, particularly as a condition of probation, to go into a program. I mean, we have far too few programs for felons in this state. We do absolutely nothing when someone is released from the penitentiary. The only things that are being done at the local level currently, primarily with some C felons. We need, in some of this, the governor's plan is intended to deal with low-level custody, halfway houses, restitution centers, some minimum security custodies, work camps, to help deal with people at a lesser incarcerative rate, but not just dump them on the street. Currently, they're being dumped on the street in Salem and in Portland. They're given a chit to stay in a hotel for a very short period of time. They have no support whatsoever, and they end up back in their life of crime, even if they want to do something else. There's no effort made. There's no ability, not effort. You have your parole and probation officers that do the best they can, but there's no support structure for people coming out of the penitentiary. They don't stay there long, particularly on property crimes now. Then they're sent out on pre-probation, early release, for a period of months. Then they're put pre-parole, early release. And then they're put on parole. But there's no support. There's no halfway house. There's no way to make sure these people have a job and some support before you turn them loose and say, there you are, folks, you're on the street, now do good and don't get into trouble anymore. And that's not the way we're going to deal with our crime problem.
Thank you.
Sheriff, you mentioned a recognition that if the state at this point, given the other corrections initiatives that are going on and the cost of those programs, that the funding portion of which yours would be about, and just in this county alone, about $4 million, we're not able to do that, you would still be supportive of adopting this as a policy position in the state and then phasing that in.
Absolutely.
But you mentioned you had some concerns about how that would be phased in. Were you specific on that, or are you just simply?
No, I'm not. I'm not specific. I think I think it's important to begin doing it, and if it takes between now and the next legislature to deal, whether it's a couple of years, 3 years, whatever it is, in order to adequately do that statewide, at least we are heading towards that as a goal, and we know where we're going to end. The courts bill was a good example. That took 5 years. That was even more expensive, but that took 5 years to phase in. And I really think that as much as I think it ought to be done, and I think it can be done within the governor's initiative, the majority of it, between the governor's initiative and the funds that community corrections perhaps will be released up. There's a similar proposal that will not require the $3,000 payback. Now, if some of those funds and the ability to use a portion of the current funds for minimum security incarceration were put together with the governor's initiative, I believe that the funding for this will not increase beyond what currently is proposed in the governor's budget. Now, I may be overly optimistic, and I'm willing to admit that that's true. But in looking at the 900 beds, the amount of problem felons in the state, particularly in this county, we're trying to identify in the state now, so we get a better handle on what it is. I think it's a realistic possibility within this biennium.
Fred, I understand that your own division or department is facing a budget problem just in this current budget. I think one figure I saw was approximately $1 million or more. How much of that is attributable, if any, to your responsibility now to take care of these state prisoners?
Well, quite frankly, we would not have the financial problem we had today if I didn't have the 250 state prisoners.
Thank you.
Further questions? Sheriff, thanks for being with us. We appreciate
your
testimony. Thank you very much. Multnomah County Chairperson Gladys McCoy. I got that title right. We changed charters and I wasn't...
When you weren't looking.
Is that the right...
I want to thank Representative Burton for sponsoring this bill and thank the subcommittee for bringing this opportunity to us here in Multnomah County. I come before you as both the county executive and chairman of the board of county commissioners. As Sheriff Hurst has mentioned, it is this bill, the very first sentence in this bill embodies the number one priority on our legislative agenda. And I only want to make those two points. One, this bill is extremely important to us, and so of course we support it wholeheartedly. And the point is that we want you to accept the full responsibility as the state to take care of all felons. You've heard the sheriff's testimony. It can make an appreciable difference in the number of people we have to be concerned about. But from my perspective, since it is the board who deals with the sheriff's budget, it can make a significant impact on our budget if we didn't have the cost of the felons in our facility. The second point I want to make has to do with the state's ability and the county's ability to plan. We can't do that now when we have to have felons in our facilities. Without them, either you would provide the cost of them, which would eliminate the pressure on our county budget, our general fund dollars, which means that we could then provide other services for inmates. Or if you had them totally out of our facilities, the number of people who are released daily could be significantly reduced. And we would, in fact, be housing the people who are appropriate to be housed in our facilities. So we want the convicted felons out of our facilities. We want the ability to plan a public safety program for our community that our citizens really need and deserve.
Thank you. The questions, just as an overview, Gladys, if you had $4 million, today in your budget, if you were able to get part of that, so what's the county not doing that it would be able to do if it had those kinds of funds? What are we denying you in a sense?
There are a couple of things that we can do, and of course there are many more, but I think when we look at the number of the kinds of folks who are incarcerated in our facility and realize that a number of them are there because of drug and alcohol related behavior, we could certainly provide tremendous services, treatment services for those folks. We know that we have people out there now who would wish to be rid of their drug problem, and when they ask for volunteer treatment, there are not enough facilities and programs out there to provide it. I think we need to not necessarily provide the direct service, but certainly we could provide some development funds so that other people in the community could provide those services. If we could get those people out of our facility, it again would free up a lot of space.
Okay. Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you very much, Gladys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Miller of Salem.
Did I write if I change that to your House Bill 2333?
That's fine. I know that we're hearing on several bills. Mayor Harris has, in her community down the valley, a number of our state facilities, and we are really talking about a number of issues. And so I know you've got to get back down. I appreciate your coming up, but if you'd talk to us about whatever bill you like, Mayor, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's nice to see you again. Last time I saw you, I think we were on a tour of the correctional facilities in Salem. And it's nice to see you on this side of the walls as well. I'm here. We're all relieved to leave, I know. I'm here to speak tonight to strongly endorse House Bill 2333, which is obviously the creation of a Department of Corrections. And our endorsement for this bill comes primarily from our feeling that it really begins to focus the state's attention on what is obviously a statewide crisis in Oregon. We believe the fact that it establishes corrections as a state priority, with that department reporting directly to the governor, is exactly the kind of attention this issue needs. We have for too long allowed the limitation of available prison space to basically dictate our method of dealing with felons. And certainly the sheriff has indicated what many of the problems in Multnomah County are, and I have a feeling if Marion County were here this evening, they would just second much of what the sheriff has said. The solution that's been used because of the lack of space in general has been long-term leaves, which is kind of a nice way of saying early release and just put the people back on the street. As your sheriff has said, the streets are basically in Portland and in Salem, and we can no longer stand that. As I've mentioned to many of you, the city of Salem has had a study done by the Bureau of Governmental Research in Eugene, and I want to just share two of the findings of that study, which I believe indicate why. Residents 6 years ago to 17.7 per 10,000 residents in 1985. An equally disturbing trend in our community, we commit 9.2% of the correctional facility clients in 1985. In the same year, 17.5% of those clients were discharged into the Salem area, which is just an indication of the real burden that our community and the surrounding communities have been expected to take. And we believe by having a new focus on this, and certainly that includes funding to get the governor's corrections initiative implemented, it will help the entire Mid-Willamette Valley enormously in dealing with what is our number one issue. We would encourage that the new Department of Corrections, upon its formation, immediately look at and review the release policies used by the state of Oregon. Secondly, that they look at how to reduce the enormously high rate of escapes. And as you know, Oregon has the highest rate of escapes of any state in the country, not exactly what we're hoping to have as one of our number one achievements. And the impact on Salem, we know in our burglary rates, is certainly directly related to the escapes. And certainly last but not least, the department needs to immediately look at the overcrowding situation, which ties into the new beds, and also the staffing level, and from our perspective, especially the staffing level at the CDRC. That's where the highest percentage of escapes comes from as far as those inmates who are incarcerated as opposed to those who just don't show up after they're released. So those are issues that we hope the new department will look at immediately. In addition to those, obviously the legislature is going to need to appropriate funds and also to give the governor siting authority. And as we have said before, and 11 mayors in the valley have endorsed it, we urge the legislature to make the governor's initiative work, which means to give it the clout it needs and also the money it needs to implement it. And that is basically our message. And we appreciate the time and also the leadership you all are taking in this area.
Any questions? Commissioner Springer?
Mayor Miller, could you just give us a quick recap as to what the status is with your jail? I know you've been under federal court order, and apparently your voters have approved a construction project which is now underway. Could you maybe just outline that briefly for us?
Sure. Marion County went to the voters about a year ago and asked for approximately $15.5 million to build a new regional facility, primarily targeted on Marion County, but they're anticipating that Polk and Yamhill will also use some of the bed space. The current facility has been under court order for a number of years to basically reduce the population, and it's at the point now where it's only people who are waiting to be sentenced or waiting to be tried who are in the facility. Otherwise, they have to be released. There's no place to put them. On Christmas Eve, somebody went through City Hall and knocked out probably a dozen windows, including one in my office, and the man was released from the county jail before our officers could get the report written. And that's, I'm sure, not a new story for you all to hear, but it's a clear indication of the fact it's a real crisis. It's not just something that would be nice to find a solution to down the road.
So basically, the federal court and your space limitations mean that you don't have any sentenced felons in your facility at all?
No.
So your
the
judges...
The state is our only holding area for felons.
How are your judges responding to that? Do you have any sense of...
Frustration. I'm sure the way most judges around the state are responding. You know, we've tried to put together some community development programs and alternatives to jail, but when you start dealing with felons as opposed to just misdemeanors, you've got a whole nother population, and you know that better than I do. It's not working. It's a system that is totally fallen apart. And I believe the new jail will remedy that to a great extent, but the county commissioners are the first to say it will be full the day it opens.
Thank you.
President Miller?
You mentioned we're number one in escapes.
Yes.
Could you give me a number or something that goes beyond that?
Representative Miller, I'm not sure I have that with me tonight, but I could certainly submit that to you tomorrow. I didn't bring the whole study, but...
Is that all facilities or just the state?
Oh, the state correctional facilities.
Okay.
Let me see. What I do have is this. Oregon ranks number one in the country in escapes with 260 per 1,000 inmates, or 26%. Colorado is number two with 60 per 1,000 inmates. Now, as I said, escapes is defined...
Wait, run those by me again.
Oh.
You said we have 260
per
1,000 compared
the
to Colorado, which is 60
per
1,000.
And as I indicated, Oregon defines escapes also as those people who don't show up for trial or, you know, just don't come back for parole or whatever. So it's not just people who walk away from the release center or go over the wall. In fact, not many go over the wall at all. But it's the release center and the farm annex that have the highest number of escapes from an institutional standpoint.
Excuse me. Can I follow up?
Yeah. Do you have any idea if Colorado makes a similar measurement, or they're 60, the ones that are jumping over the
wall? Over
walls?
The wall? I don't know that. And our study that the Bureau of Governmental Research has done may, I imagine they would have that detail, and I can find that out and let you know.
Okay. Did you have something on this?
Well, if I could follow up on that, I'm wondering if part of that 260 are also include the temporary leaves who walk.
Yes.
So that's included in.
Right. So it is certainly tied up in the fact we don't have enough cells to put these people in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just also, you mentioned you'd like the Corrections Division to review release policy. Do you have just a few brief comments you might want to make now? I suppose we'll hear more later, but...
I'd be glad to let you hear it now or later. Really, what we're focusing on, once again, is the long-term leaves, the temporary leaves, the whole way the state is dealing with its overcrowding situation. And when we went through the institutions, I think the superintendents were very upfront about saying, we get a list in the morning, usually from Multnomah County, telling us how many are coming in, and we just have to go through a pecking order of who do we send out the back door. And sending out the back door frequently means into Salem, or they come back up and get bussed back up to Multnomah County. But the overcrowding issue is exactly what the long-term or short-term and temporary releases are trying to take care of. And that's where the impact on our community comes from.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
President Bellman?
Follow-up. Can you tell the committee what they're sent out with? How are these people equipped when they're released?
Well, my understanding, and this is mostly from the tour and asking that question there, is that they're sent out with very little cash, perhaps $50, and some clothes, and hopefully they are sent to a family or a friend and expected to be housed at least in the foreseeable future with somebody, as opposed to literally opening the back door and having them walk away. So they may get a bus ticket to go wherever a family or friend might be located. Other than that, there seems to be no programs available. One of the programs the city is asked every year to fund in the Salem area is an ex-offender employment program, trying to, you know, find out where some employment possibilities for the ex-offenders would be and to train them and give them some skills. And I believe the city puts in about $10,000, maybe $15,000 a year as part of our social service package. But obviously that's totally inadequate to do a good job of retraining anybody.
Mayor Miller, thank you very much for coming up and for your support on this issue. And we'll be seeing much more of you, I'm sure, down
in Salem. Yes, see you back in Salem. Thank you
very much. Judge James Ellis.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before the committee. I'm not going to speak to the technical aspects of House Bill 2437. I wanted to speak a little more generally, and I'll try to be brief, on three aspects that I would urge that the committee consider in connection with the general problem presented by this proposal. I'm confident that all of you are able to see the fiscal impact that this involves: financial assistance from the state to counties, and particularly to Multnomah County. That's why Multnomah County is interested in it, because it will either move the prisoners out of Multnomah County or require the state to pay for their keep here. And what I want to suggest to you is that I think there are strong reasons why the legislature should be sympathetic to the plight of Multnomah County and the city of Portland. This is not an area where Multnomah County has not done its part over the years and presently in dealing with the crime problem in Oregon. As an example, Multnomah County had a county probation department at county expense before there was community corrections that supplemented the work of the state corrections division. Multnomah County provides services of value in the criminal justice field to the entire state. As an example, traditionally, I'm not certain this still goes on, but when persons are picked up anywhere in the state of Oregon who are what are called federal fugitives, that is, they're charged with crossing state borders as a fugitive, a federal offense, the marshal's office, I believe, still returns them to Multnomah County. All of the federal prisoners, or most of the federal prisoners that are being held for the federal courts that cover the entire state of Oregon, are housed here in the Multnomah County Jail. There's a contract, and of course the marshal pays for it, but that segment of the jail is not available for county prisoners. I don't know what the exact number it is. That's a service to the entire state. And in addition to that, the traditional disposition of federal fugitive charges is that then a state fugitive charge is filed, and the prisoner is extradited through the state system. That's done by the Multnomah County District Attorney, and I can't tell you that I know it's still being done now, but for years and years and years, if a prisoner was picked up in Klamath Falls or Ontario, they were brought to Portland as a federal prisoner, and then the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office handled the fugitive proceeding. And when I asked once why we were doing this, at great expense to the taxpayers of Multnomah County, because the county was then providing the lawyer for that fugitive, the explanation was, well, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office does them all the time. They know how to do it. That's the first part of the background. The second thing is that everyone understands that crime is an urban phenomenon, some kinds of crime. But let me just suggest a couple of figures to you in this area. The 1986 crime figures are not available. I don't believe, at least I don't have them, but for 1985, Multnomah County, with I think 22-23% of the population of the state, had 40% of Oregon's murders and 70% of Oregon's robberies. Now, I suppose the rest of the state could say, well, that's Portland's problem or that's Multnomah County's problem, but it's Oregon's problem. Oregon cannot afford to have Portland or Multnomah County known as one of the worst crime centers in the nation. We don't want it and we can't afford it. That's not the image that I can't conceive that that's the image the state wants to project. So it's a problem for the whole state because this is the big population center for the state, and it isn't limited just to this county, it's the tri-county area. In terms of caseload, just to give you an example, because this is what causes the problem in the jail, the Multnomah County Circuit Court felony caseload for the last quarter, the last 3 months of 1986, went up about 50% over 1985. So far, in January, there's nothing to indicate that that trend is not continuing. That's why I think you need to pay close attention to a plea from Multnomah County for financial help in dealing with the crime problem that is a problem, I feel, for the whole state. The second two things that I want to suggest, not just pertain to this bill, but generally, I would urge that the committee, in its role in examining any proposals in the criminal law field, do what I'm afraid we have not done over the years. The thing that's gotten us in the jackpot we're in as to local jails, as to cost of indigent defense, as to state corrections facilities, and that is to examine each proposal in terms of its fiscal impact, not just on the proponents, but on the police, on the local jail, on the district attorney, on indigent defense, on the courts, on the probation, state corrections divisions, field services, and on state prisons. Because almost every one of these measures affects all of these. I can't resist telling you, I heard on the radio yesterday the mayor of Portland proposal for another 30 policemen, and all I could think of was we can't handle the people the police are arresting now. That'll just mean more people that I'll be releasing every week because there's no room for them in the jail. It seems to me that, and that leads me to the third thing that I want to mention, because I think they're related. In all of the problems in the criminal law, it seems to me that the thing that we have not done, and I think all of us who have responsibility to the electorate may be guilty of this, we've not publicly invited the fixing of priorities. We respond to different special interest groups. Somebody's concerned about sex abuse of children, and we pass a new law that strengthens the enforcement of that area. Someone's concerned about domestic violence, and we pass a law on that. Someone's concerned about driving under the influence, and we pass a law on that. And each one of these, viewed by itself, is no doubt a sound proposal, and there are good reasons for passing the statute, but the result is when we try to make everything important, nothing is important. And what I'd like to suggest is that your committee consider looking at the criminal law, the specific crimes, to see if perhaps we can do some better prioritizing. You are entitled, that is, the legislature is entitled, to force the rest of the components of the criminal justice system to devote the assets to the things that are the most important. Frankly, the situation now is the point where, from what you've heard from the mayor of Salem, where they have county jails that cannot be used for prisoners because they're holding sentenced prisoners because they're filled with pretrial people, state corrections institutional population that works like a pipeline where you push one in one end and another pops out the other. We're not determining who ought to come out anymore. We're just finding somebody to release, and frankly that's about what I'm doing in the local jail. Let me suggest some examples where I think you could consider whether we're appropriately spending our resources. Inflation, simply the change in the value of the dollar, has made a whole bunch of crimes felonies that used to be misdemeanors. When the our current criminal code was drafted. If someone ran into a department store and grabbed a man's suit and ran out, it was theft too, misdemeanor theft, because the suit wouldn't have been worth $200. Now you'd have to be careful what store you went in, or you'd have to pick around in the rack to find one that's less than $200. So you're talking about a felony. And that kind of theft is no more important to the public now than it was when the criminal code was drafted.
Wait for a sale.
Yeah, I guess that's the answer. There are a whole list of crimes where the seriousness of the crime is measured in terms of economic damage to the victim. And it seems to me you might want to consider whether that ought to be, the term that's used in taxing is indexed for inflation. $200 is the current figure. I'd suggest maybe $1,000 is probably fairly close, and you could look at the Consumer Price Index for when the drafting was done. The code was adopted in 1971, I believe, but the drafting was done in the late 60s. As an example of the lack of priorities, let me suggest to you the kind of, I think, indefensible things we're doing. Two crimes. Someone steals a credit card and uses it to make a $20 purchase. Or someone mugs an elderly citizen on the street. Robbery, unarmed, one person alone. Those crimes are of equal seriousness. They're both Class C felonies, and the maximum sentence is 5 years in the penitentiary. And it just seems to me that that is indefensible. And if the reason the mugger who got 5 years is released in 3 months is because there's somebody who did a $20 forgery waiting to get into the institution, there's something seriously wrong. Another example of one that where we've labeled something a felony, and I think we're in effect just punishing the public, welfare fraud. Almost every welfare fraud involves a woman who has small children and is on aid-dependent children and gets a job and then lies to her caseworker and does not reveal the income she's earned. That accounts, I would imagine, for 95% of all welfare fraud cases. It's a felony, punishable by up to 3 years in the penitentiary. Just as soon as she comes into court, you know the Indigent Defense Fund has to provide her with a lawyer. That goes with the territory. That's $546. A lot of these welfare frauds are only about $1,000, $1,500. It seems to me we are adding to the injury to the public when we devise a system that involves furnishing her with a lawyer at $546 so that the lawyer can come in and plead her guilty so she can be put on probation. And that's exactly what happens in almost all these cases.
Judge, may I ask, what discretion does the district attorney's office have to treat these as misdemeanors or to bring a reduced charge?
I don't know that anybody knows of a lesser included charge for welfare fraud. The law on the books is a felony. There's no economic value to it. I suppose they don't take the smaller cases, but I can't think of any way they can make it a misdemeanor. And the contract firms, contracts provide, if the case is a felony, they get the contract rate. And you also have to bring it in circuit court, where we have all of the expensive aspects of a trial. Well, of course, there isn't going to be a trial. I'm not sure I've ever had a trial. Welfare fraud, and I've probably sentenced hundreds of people for that offense. The driving while suspended thing, 40% of our caseload for the circuit court in Multnomah County consists of driving while suspended and drugs. Now, I don't mean to minimize the seriousness of driving while suspended and the related driving under the influence, and I certainly don't mean to minimize the seriousness of the drug problem, but do we want to spend 40% of our court, district attorney, indigent defense, pre-sentence capacity assets on those two classes of offenses? To make that decision, you have to look at what the other crimes are, and residential burglary certainly deserves some attention. It seems to me that it might be worth considering, going back to misdemeanor, driving while suspended, and if the concern is driving under the influence, consider perhaps making the repeat driving under the influence the felony, or at least limit driving while suspended as a felony to people who are suspended because of driving under the influence. Let me suggest just an example because I think this clarifies the nature of the problem. One of the last people I had before me for a month or so ago for driving while suspended, the man had had a driving under the influence in the late 60s, was suspended. State told him not to drive anymore, and he drove two more times in the early 70s. For that, his license to drive was revoked for 10 years. And I got him a year or two ago for felony driving while suspended. He's looking at 5 years in the penitentiary. His driving under the influence was in the 60s, and his last moving violation was in 1977. I felt a little awkward. I suspect he had, in the most recent 8 years, one of the best driving records in the courtroom. I don't think I was the only person who'd had a moving violation since 1977. No. And he has an appointed lawyer, cost the public $546. And he comes in and pleads guilty, no qualms about that, plead guilty to the felony, because obviously he's going to get probation. Now, why do we want to classify that as a felony and then not spend time that ought to be spent on repeat felons who are hurting people? And I realize this is not precisely germane to your topic, but that affects the volume of the felonies, and it might, in a sense, hurt the county's position, because if you made some of these offenses misdemeanors, then they undoubtedly would be the county's responsibility, but it changes the whole emphasis of law enforcement. The last category I'd suggest you might want to look at are the drugs. In two directions. First, as to the large quantities of drugs, perhaps consider the legislative presumption that has been made in some jurisdictions that if you're in possession of a large quantity of drugs, it's for the purpose of distributing, and there's no reason to distinguish between that kind of possession and people who are actually caught delivering drugs, because that's you're obviously dealing, you've got a dealer. But at the other end, perhaps consider taking the small quantities, user quantities, and these things could be arrived at legislatively, make those possession cases misdemeanors. That would force all of us in the criminal justice system to focus on the serious cases. And that does not always occur now. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. I did need to say one thing, and that is that the views I'm expressing are entirely my own. I'm not here speaking on behalf of anyone else, let alone other judges.
Judge, we appreciate your being here. I know there are several other bills going through the system this time, some of which would, in fact, index up or down the amounts of money you're talking about on felony crimes that we've seen. And there's also, of course, an effort going on, we may hear from someone tonight in the Criminal Justice Council, to take a look at sentencing guidelines and some other long-term effects. I think what you're saying makes sense in the system, and this particular bill is a component of the larger cause, and appreciate your comments on that. Are there questions, Representative Springer?
Yeah, Judge, this is a question which I think I posed earlier to another witness, and it relates to the judge's discretion to now under current law to sentence to the county jail as a condition of probation. No one is sure whether or not we're going to be able to find the money that Multnomah County and the other counties need, and there are not a whole lot of other options. One option that has been discussed is limiting, or some have even gone so far as to suggest eliminating entirely the option now to sentence. How would that impact you, or how do you think it would impact your colleagues on the bench, and what would be the effect on the system if a change like that were to be made?
Well, I've tried to think about this because I was aware the bill was going to be presented, and of course it's been discussed in this community, and I can't be sure. I certainly don't know how anybody else would react. What I've thought is, would a judge send someone to the penitentiary mm-hmm. if the judge really thought that what they needed was 90 days in the county jail or 90 days in jail? I doubt that. I don't think that's very likely to happen, although in an era where 5 years in the penitentiary for a Class C felony more likely means about 90 days, maybe that's just as reasonable a thing to do. One of the reasons the county jails have more appeal, I think, to judges is the opportunity for transitional release. The state no longer operates work release centers, some people still think that that is a way to get people back on the streets without inviting further criminal activity. I rather think that you'd have the two levels. If the judge really thought that only a short jail sentence was appropriate and the only alternative is to send somebody to the penitentiary, you can't send somebody to the penitentiary for less than a year, even though we know they serve substantially less than that. But if a judge doesn't want to do that, I suppose then the alternative would be just straight probation with no jail time at all. And that wouldn't be the end of the world. but it, it, you do lose some flexibility. There is the additional thing that the judge does have continuing authority to modify a county jail sentence and does not as to a state corrections division sentence. Once the prisoner is sentenced to the state corrections division and delivered to the institution, the judge's authority ends, other than appellate courts. A question?
Yes.
Is it Bowman?
How you talk about continuing authority, and you also mentioned the really sad lack statewide of a state-sponsored work release program. How good is the information that you receive on people you sentence after you've sentenced them? I mean, do they just sort of fall off the edge of the world, or do you find out if certain programs are successful at following jail or as a condition of probation? What is the quality of your information?
I think it's pretty good. I have great admiration for the people who do the supervision, both Multnomah County probation officers and State Corrections Division probation officers. The limiting thing is the numbers they're up against. State Corrections Division probation officers, I think, are carrying caseloads of upward of 80 people, and that's more significant than the numbers sound, because we're giving them people to supervise who we think live under the west end of the Burnside Bridge but may live under the east end. You know, the really pretty difficult thing to supervise. But from we receive reports from them, we receive reports from the institutions. Multnomah County does operate work release, and in my case, at least, I think I'm kept pretty well informed what these people are doing while they're at the county correctional facility, which is now being used for that.
Well, you get information then both on the people who are successfully working through their programs and on the people who are failing.
Yes. Let me tell you specifically how I do it, and this may be unique, and I started this as an experiment. I was told a little over a year ago that the Multnomah County Intensive Supervision Project, which was intended to take people out of jail and give them very close supervision with curfews in their home and that kind of thing, as an alternative to leaving them in jail for the full sentence, that they could take more prisoners. So I set up a program that my secretary operates to review each person I sentence to the county jail at the end of a third of the actual number of days they're going to serve. If they're getting along all right and their probation officer and counselor in the jail agree, put them on work release. At the end of the second third, if they're still getting along all right and they've got a job, then I release them under intensive supervision. So that's kind of a formalized way of ensuring that I get feedback on those people. And it, the ones who've made it to intensive supervision, all but one have made it through the intensive supervision.